sun, I say it's alright. It's alright. Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say it's alright. It's alright. Little darling, it's been a long, cold and lonely winter. Little darling, it feels like years since you've been here.
Hey everybody, remember me? This is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. I've had a very interesting set of trips to Europe, which you know about, and came back from the United Nations. Then I spent a week deep in the dark bowels of the criminal justice system on jury duty, an experience in itself. And now I'm back, and hopefully we can get some rhythm going and get some shows back to back to back, because I need some rhythm myself to, you know, being a host. Each show builds off the next one, so hopefully there won't be any fun drive for a little bit, or special programs, or jury duty, or other things. And I have an interesting show today, or as Ed Sullivan used to say before your time, we have a really, really, really big show, which he said every week. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to do a little bit of talking about some of the items in the news with some commentary. And I'm going to talk about four books that I like. A lot of you actually like that I read to you. It's not the main thing we do on Voices, but it is a piece of what we do on Voices. And that's because it's becoming a lost art, reading. So I've been trying to think of some of the books that I like. I wanted to go to the phones today. I increasingly just like going to the phones for my own development, because I don't know how you do a whole show without listening to somebody. It's really important for me to get the listeners coming back to me. It gives me a much better sense of why I'm doing the show, who's out there. And I want to say to you listeners at Voices that you're really good. I mean, you're just really good in a whole lot of ways. But one of the things is you're really good on calling into the show and knowing how to get to the point. I listen to some shows where, very frankly, the listeners go off and on, and sometimes they're kind of regular, lonely people, nothing wrong with that, but you got to remember when you call into a radio show that hopefully we have 20, 30, 40,000 people listening, so you're supposed to be part of the entertainment, and I think our listeners do that. They very deeply moving comments. Now, today, unfortunately, the phones is off, so we're not going to have going to the phones today. So I'm going to do a full hour of programming, but you can tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks. Now, I'm trying to appeal to, as they say, a younger demographic, or at least a Twitterier demographic, which means if any of you know how to send a tweet, I want you to send me a tweet just to say that you're alive at Eric Mann Speaks, which would be great. And also to send me the name of your favorite book. Either that could be the favorite book that you're reading at the time, your favorite all-time book. That would be very hard for me to pick my favorite all-time book, but at least one. You have to list with one, at Eric Mann Speaks, and I will get the tweets and I'll read them on the air. So I'm going to start with some commentary about the news today. And then we're going to go to books that I like and books that you should read. Now, the first one is from the Union of Concerned Scientists. It's called The Climate Deception Dossiers. Internal fossil fuel industry memos reveal decades of corporate disinformation. The lead authors are Kathy Mulvey and Seth Shulman. And it was published in July 2015, which is... we're in July 2015, so that's really great. So I have not read it yet, but I'm going to read the, I like introductions. So It's called The Real Climate Hoax. So I'm going to read you some of this. And again, folks, what I'm going to try to do is give you articles to read, reports to read, books to read, you know, records to listen to. And so this is from the Climate Deception Dossiers, Internal Fossil Fuel Industry Memos Reveal Decades of Corporate Disinformation from the Union of Concerned Scientists. So you can go online and get it. Okay. U.S. Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, now chair of the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Environment and Public Works, has famously and repeatedly called climate change a hoax. In addition to his frequent claims, Inhofe went so far as to bring a snowball into a Senate floor to somehow illustrate his point. Of course, Senator Inhofe fails to acknowledge the overwhelmingly evidence of global warming. The science has been clear for decades that the planet is rapidly warming, and emissions of heat-trapping gases from the burning of fossil fuels are largely to blame. But Senator Inhofe is right about one thing that has been a climate hoax that continues today. It is a decades-long campaign by a handful of the world's largest fossil fuel companies, such as Chevron, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and Peabody Energy, to deceive the American public by distorting the realities and risks of climate change, sometimes acting directly and sometimes acting indirectly through trade associations and front groups. Now, I'm going to read you just another section from here. It says, what fossil fuel companies knew and when they knew it. The fundamentals of global warming have been well established for generations. The idea that heat trapping emissions could alter our climate dates back to the late 1880s. By the 1950s, scientists knew that the climate change could present significant risk to people and places. In 1965, the highly respected oceanographer Roger Revelle explained in a report prepared for the President's Science Advisory Committee that increasingly amounts of carbon dioxide could be trapped in the atmosphere and function, much like the glass in a greenhouse, to raise the temperature of the lower air. In 1965, President Lyndon Johnson warned about the potential dangers of a changing climate. In a special message to Congress, he said, quote, air pollution is no longer confined to isolated places. This generation has altered the composition of the atmosphere on a global scale through radioactive materials and a steady increase in carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. Okay, now, in some ways, I guess I'm also going to say that this is sort of both for our listeners and others what I'm going to call the low-hanging fruit. That is to say, it's not going to be hard to convince you that the oil companies lie and that the oil companies distort the impact of climate change. But I'm going to fast forward to a report that I couldn't find in enough time to get on the show today, which I did hear on the Tom Hartman show at 2 o'clock, which was that there's a new report from 4,000 scientists in preparation for the December 2015 climate conference. It's called the United Nations Climate Change Conference, UNCCC. And I'm going to be going there along with Barbara Lott-Holland from the Labor Community Strategy Center, Manuel Criollo, Ashley Franklin, and Channing Martinez from the Labor Community Strategy Center, and our Fight for the Soul of the Cities. So we're going there to demand that President Obama restrict and reduce U.S. auto and overall carbon emissions by 50% by 2025, which is only 10 years from now, and that he from 1990 levels, and he comes to Paris with a real plan. The reason I'm fast-forwarding from the climate deception is because the greatest deception right now, sadly, is coming from even the mainstream environmental movement, the Democratic Party, in that they acknowledge the seriousness of the problem, but their level of climate denial is they will not come up with the level of severity and radical solutions needed to reduce these emissions. So I haven't read the report, but I did hear Tom Hartman talking about it. I'm going to tell you what he said, and I'm going to tell you what I said about what he said, and what he said is what the scientists said. So the good thing is that the scientists are trying to sound the alarm. They are really understanding that they have been perhaps understating the severity of the problem or trying to find language to not scare people, as it were. And this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, 90.7 FM on KPFK in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. Now, the scientists have now said that if we don't take action very, very rapidly, it's going to be impossible to stop the rise in the overall temperature below 2 degrees Celsius. Now, for those of you who've been listening to our show, let me ask you a question. Do you know the number of this 2 degrees Celsius? Did you know that the number of 2 degrees Celsius means 2 degrees over 1850 levels, which I still don't know what the level is, and since I keep saying I'm going to learn it, I better not come back next Tuesday without knowing that answer. That is to say, what was the baseline of temperature above which they're trying to stop, if that makes sense. So they're trying to stop it from getting to be 2 degrees Celsius more, not 2 degrees Celsius. All right, quiz number two. Close your eyes. How far has the temperature risen, got hotter? How many degrees has the temperature warmed up since 1850? That is to say, if you don't want to get to 2 degrees Celsius, well, where are we right now? You ready to take the exam? 0.04, 0.08, 1.2, 1.6, 1.9. The answer is 0.08. That means, according to the theory, or according to the best measurable developments, the climate has warmed by 0.8 degrees in the direction of that horrible, horrible 2 degrees. Now, think again. I'm going to ask you another question. 0.8%, you understand, is like 80% of 1%, right? So it means you're almost at that 1 degree rather than that 1%. You're almost at 1 degree. You got that? So we're basically, let's say we're at 1 degree and we don't want to get at 2 degrees. Now, why do I round off the 0.8 to 1? Why do I do that? Here's another exam for you. Is the heat of the climate of the world equal all of the world? Is to say, is everybody moved up 0.8%? Or are some areas moving more rapidly than others? And are some areas moving from a higher base than others? I think you know the answer. That in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, the baseline is hotter and the rise is hotter. And sadly, the United States is not going to suffer as rapidly or as badly, even the entire United States, even the southern parts, compared to other parts of the world, which doesn't mean it's not going to get terrible. All right, so here's where I'm going with this. After the scientists have sounded the alarm, I'm interviewing you like you're my guest. What do you think is the main proposal that they are suggesting? That is to say, they are saying the world is coming to an end. All right, here's another exam. Close your eyes and think of five really bad things that climate change is doing right now. Right now. Big ones. Can you answer? All right, now I'm going to give you the answers. The first is, of course, what we call extreme weather events. That means that they've always had hurricanes, they've always had typhoons, they've always had floods, they've always had droughts, they've always had tornadoes. But when you hear the worst in the last 100 years, the worst, the hottest, the coldest, what's happening is that Category 3 hurricanes are becoming Category 5 hurricanes. Category 5 hurricanes that were very, very rare are now becoming much more common. In the Philippines, they use the word typhoon. It's the same thing as a hurricane. They have had 5 of the worst typhoons in the history of the Philippines in the last 5 years. So the first is extreme weather events. The second thing is this whole drought and flood situation. So, and this is Eric Mann giving you a little pop quiz on your climate knowledge or my own. The second thing is the cycle of droughts and floods. When you hear the word drought and you hear the word flood, in your mind, you think of two separate countries, like some countries suffer from droughts and then other countries suffer from floods. The answer would be wrong, that sadly, a lot of the same countries, the same areas, are having extreme droughts, followed by extreme floods, followed by extreme droughts. You get that. The next thing that's happening is what's called desertification, the increased amount of desert. You know that, I don't know the exact number, but at least 2/3 of the Earth's surface is ocean. But we also know that large amounts of land is not arid, is not arable. What I mean by that is you can't grow stuff on it. And sadly, a lot of the deserts are expanding. So again, sub-Saharan Africa is just getting drier and drier, and the desert is expanding. Another thing that's happening in terms of the tremendous impact is the shortening of growing seasons. And what does that mean? It means that because of climate change, either because the drought is greater or the floods are greater, the actual amount of time that you can grow food is less. And what do you think that's going to mean? Less food. So in a world of scarcity, it's going to get worse. And the fight over food and the fight over arable land is going to get greater. This is still Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines. So now these scientists who are really trying to step out on a limb, what's the main thing that they're proposing? What's the solution? The solution they came up with is a carbon tax. And what a carbon tax says is that you're going to make the use of carbon, the use of coal, the use of oil, more and more expensive. And what that's going to do theoretically is it's going to price coal out of the market, it's going to price oil out of the market, and through the blind but wonderful hand of the market, eventually people are going to come up with solar and wind and other non-polluting technologies because it's going to be cheaper to produce it, because it's going to become so expensive to produce oil and so expensive to produce coal and other forms of fossil fuels that the market will drive capitalism essentially into making it profitable to do renewable energy and unprofitable to do fossil fuels. Well, this is where scientists should stay out of politics or take responsibility that they have bad politics, because a lot of these scientists are not saying the obvious conclusion of their own science, which is the only answer is to stop the production now. The answer is to keep the fuel in the ground, as the Bolivians said, keep 80% of the fossil fuel in the world in the ground. That's right, don't produce it. Forget about market mechanisms. We need state intervention. We need the state to stop oil companies from producing oil, coal companies from producing coal, natural gas from being drilled, to stop fracking, to stop the pipeline. Now, that is what's required. That's the only thing that's going to work. And interestingly, who is the government that has the most understanding that this is the way to go, and the government that's most at least experimenting with this option? The answer is the People's Republic of China. And that is to say that China understands whether it's a capitalist economic system right now, it still has some type of a socialist theory about the role of the state. And what it says is that if the state wants to, the state can solve the problem by stopping the production. So right now in China, they have done things like, they've stopped having the cars on the road one day a week. They have stopped electricity. They just stopped it. They shut it down and everything went black. So they have figured out that the answer, if you're producing too much greenhouse gas, the answer is to not produce it. The answer is not to tell the market that maybe, if we make it so expensive, then you won't produce it, which is ridiculous because the rich will buy it at whatever price it is. You can't eliminate sin from the capitalist system because it's rooted in sin, sisters and brothers. You see what I'm saying? It's rooted in that if people with money want something, they can get it. And unless the state restricts and compels the capitalists and says you can't do it, even if it's a capitalist state, by the way, unless we stop the cars in L.A. now, no cars in L.A. now, no production of gas and oil now, if we don't do that, there will be no change. So as I'm going to be reporting to you a lot on the way to Paris, I'm locking back into trying to grasp this climate change, but in a certain way, it's not that complicated. Do you know how you end the 2.5 million people in prison? Do you do sentencing reform? We're going to get to that in the next article. Do you let nonviolent defenders, 47 of them, out? No, you just let the prisoners out. That's how you end mass incarceration. You open the prison doors and let the prisoners come out. How do you stop pollution from fossil fuels? You stop producing fossil fuels and you stop consuming fossil fuels. You make it illegal to produce fossil fuels. You use government along with social movements to force the companies to not produce it. So that's your lesson today. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. I want to thank the climate deception, and I want to thank the Union of Concerned Scientists, but I really want to thank me, because I gave you even a better analysis of how to understand that, and I'm going to try to get a transcript of this and turn it into an article. I also want to thank Barbara Lott Holland, who's done a lot of work with me on the Green Climate Fund, which we're going to talk about. And of course, what I get to on the break, I'm going to tell you all the other books I've read and all the articles I've read, because every one of these ideas I got from somebody else. Sisters and brothers, we've had a major breakthrough in the history of Voices from the Frontlines. I got a tweet, and I get more than one, but this is from Zero Badillion, who's a really terrific listener who stays in touch all the time, at Eric Mann Speaks, see it can be done. He says, I'm not in the younger demographic, parenthesis zero, neither am I, but I am listening. I'm going to recommend Labor's Untold Story by Boyer and Murray. Great, great book. Great book. You have to read. That's a wonderful book in terms of some of the classics. So come on, folks. It can be done. At Eric Mann Speaks. Tell me thoughts on the eventually monologue commentary I just made about the only way to eliminate fossil fuels is to not produce them. At Eric Mann Speaks. At Eric Mann Speaks. And I'll read your tweets as soon as they come in. I'm going to read you a couple of things now. I'm reading it because it says, Eric Garner's family says, the settlement will not stall the push for police reform. The family members of Eric Garner, this is on July 14th, 2015, in the New York Times. The family members of Eric Garner, speaking on Tuesday in Harlem, promised not to let a $5.9 million payment from New York City stall their campaign to hold accountable the police officers involved in Mr. Garner's death. In a subdued news conference, the relatives made the first public comments on the settlement reached a day earlier. Standing alongside the Reverend Al Sharpton at the National Action Network headquarters, Mr. Garner's mother, widow, and children sought to make clear that the payment would not mute their push for police reform, nor would it soften their loss. Since the settlement was reached on Monday, Gwen Carr, Mr. Garner's mother, said people on the streets have been congratulating her. Don't congratulate us. This is not a victory, she said. The victory will come when we get justice. The agreement between the family and the city reached a few days before the anniversary of Mr. Garner's death, so it was right at the anniversary of his death, headed off a lawsuit, of course, as the survivors await the outcome of a federal inquiry into the killing and several other investigations at the state and local level. This is still from the New York Times. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines. Negotiations over the settlement were sometimes complicated by divisions among Garner relatives, Mr. Sharpton said in an interview after the news conference, describing a series of phone calls and meetings that were used to mend differences to come to an accord. But he said family members who experienced tragedy did not always see eye to eye. None of this is new to me, he said. I've learned how to navigate that. Yeah, you had disagreements in the family on strategy tactics, he added, declining to go into detail. At the end of the day, they are good people committed to justice. He said he told the family, at the end of the day, things come and go. You want to be remembered fighting for justice. On Tuesday, family members revived their calls for the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of New York to bring a federal case against the officers involved in Mr. Garner's death. His relatives also offered their first public explanation for why they agreed to a settlement before the other inquiries were completed. One of Mr. Garner's daughter, Emerald Garner, 23, who is now working in crisis management at the National Action Network, said in an interview that the family wanted to avoid the pain of having his death replayed publicly. She said the family decided it was best to settle now if we can avoid watching the video again in front of 50 million people. The family's comments on Tuesday, she said, were intended to correct the perception that they were money hungry before it got out of hand. Mr. Garner died on July 17, 2014, after an officer used a chokehold, a maneuver prohibited by the police department, to bring him to the ground. Mr. Garner, who was unarmed, was suspected of selling untaxed cigarettes. The chokehold was cited by the medical examiner as the cause of Mr. Garner's death. Mr. Sharpton sought to play down the role of the National Action Network in the settlement, saying repeatedly that the group had not taken any money from the family. He said the national movement set off by the killing of Mr. Garner and by the fatal shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, soon after would not stop until we have changed how policing goes. Money is a recognition of the loss of the family, he said, but it does not deal with the criminal and other wrongdoing done to his family and other families. Jewel Miller, whose daughter with Mr. Garner was born a few months before his death, did not appear at the news conference. The daughter, Legacy, will receive part of the city's payment. In a phone interview on Tuesday afternoon, Ms. Miller echoed the calls for accountability beyond the settlement. It's a buyout without justice, she said. They pay us without the justice. Where's the justice at? Gee, if you could put on some Nina Simone, I'm going to take a short break, and then I'm going to come back because I do want to comment on this article. Okay? Thank you.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say. It's all right. It's all right. Here comes the sun.
So, hey everybody, welcome back. This is Eric Mann, you're on Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. Hope Hank Askin is listening. I know I have one listener at least in Santa Barbara. And most importantly, perhaps streaming live on the web at kpfk.org, where I'm hoping Peter and Phyllis Scaller are listening in New York. Now, I do want to make a few comments carefully, but I do want to comment on these commentaries. Now, the first thing is that the family received a settlement. They deserve a cash settlement. The use of cash settlements has always been one element of how the system, sadly, pays for mutilations and deaths. So, obviously, that in itself has a very tragic and bizarre element to it. It's almost like it's built into the budget that you kill a certain number of black people and Latinos, and then at the end, if there's a threat of a suit, and if the people think they have a good suit, then it comes out of the government's money to pay. The problem with settlements is, as is reflected in this article, it's a political response, and it's a very limited one. Obviously, let's start, we'll say it 10 times, the family is entitled to large cash settlements. It's one way the system, until we get a better system. Certainly, what's the alternative? Not to give a cash settlement. The paying of these settlements, though, I think we know has no deterrent whatsoever. It's built in, it's just built into the way the capitalism polices. You beat and kill large numbers of people, and occasionally somebody takes you to court with an ironclad case and you settle. But then there's also another problem, which is there are fights over money. And it's difficult if you have families fighting over and disagreeing over the settlement, because these are political categories. And as I don't want to... Jewel Miller, whose daughter with Mr. Garner was born a few months before his death, did not appear at the news conference. In a phone interview, Ms. Miller echoed the calls for accountability beyond the settlement. "It's a buyout without justice," she said. "They pay us out without the justice. Where's the justice at?" So let's be clear, just in terms of her voice, it's a buyout without justice. Her argument, and I'm only quoting her argument, is that the cash settlement, in her view, should have been part of a broader settlement. Then you have the role of Al Sharpton. He's a very important political figure. He brokers relationships between the police and families. You can judge whatever you want, but the National Action Network is mentioned throughout this conversation. And all of you need to check out the National Action Network and make your own assessments of the role that he plays. But I want to get to a more fundamental issue that's really relevant to both this story and also to the story about climate change, which is the role of demand development. One of the ways that movements can avoid some of the internal contradictions, if there's really a clear understanding of what people are fighting for and what people are demanding. Obviously, that's, I think, one of the strong suits of my work. I spend a lot of time thinking about what are the kind of demands which, if one, have a highly ideological impact. Why is that as the first thing? Because you don't fundamentally change the system through a set of mechanical changes in its behaviors. I mean, certainly it's very important to win higher wages. It's very important to even reduce the number of police. It's very important to, for some people think, getting cameras or getting cash settlements. I don't want to debate those things. But the first thing that I think is very important is what's the ideological content of a demand. So when we would say 1,000 more buses, 1,000 less police, and yes, I did make that up, the goal is to get somebody to think, wait a minute, you're saying you want 1,000 more buses and 1,000 less police, right? Do I want less police? That's a real demand, by the way. We really want 1,000 less police. You don't make up ideological demands that have no content to them. So this is a real question. I've been arguing, and this is important, I'll just keep writing and writing a lot in the future about debates I want to hope that I can contribute to the movement. I've been saying to people, what's the best way to cut police brutality by 50%? Okay, I want you to think. What do you think is the best way? And I'm arguing the best way is to cut the total number of police by 50% and the total number of hours that they're on the street. Because if police brutality is inherent in policing, then unless you cut the total number of police, you can't even begin to cut the amount of police brutality. There's others who have said, no, no, no. I remember going to certain community groups in South LA and say, would you support 1,000 more buses, 1,000 less police? And one community leader said no, because a lot of our people like police. But I think we want to work on training the police more, focusing on police behavior. And I think it's been shown that you cannot change police behavior. You just can't, because they're doing, that's their job. They're doing their job. So what I'm getting to is that in the debate over the Garner situation, even if the question is indicting the specific police who killed Eric Garner in a chokehold, right next to him was another kid who was beaten within half of his or her life and didn't die and is probably right now rotting in the middle of a cell in the Tombs, which is one of the worst prisons in the world. It's in New York City. Or how many right now, because I was in prison for a year and a half, right now, how many prisoners are getting beaten badly by the prison guards? We're not going to sue one at a time, one case at a time, one settlement at a time. We have to free the U.S. 2.5 million. We really got to get people out of prison. That's a real demand. The demands that we're trying to make right now, that President Obama cut, end the Defense Department 1033 program, means that the president will end a program that's giving military-grade weapons to the police. Will that cut down on the number of kids who are killed? Ironically, not necessarily. Not necessarily, because they have plenty of lethal force without these tanks, without these MRAPs, without these grenades. But it will be a political defeat for the police. It'll be a political defeat for the school board that right now is defending these weapons, the 61 M16s that the Los Angeles School Police Department has, and that so far that the Los Angeles Unified School District is supporting. So if, in fact, they have to say, we want out of the program, President Obama, we want out of the program, we disassociate ourselves with it, and, Mr. President, we want you to end the whole 1033 program, and if the president does, it's a vote of no confidence in the police, and that's, and it also demilitarizes or restricts their military capacity. So what I'm getting to is you look for demands that are counter-hegemonic in ideology, counter-hegemonic in terms of their structure, counter-hegemonic in the sense of they change power relationships. The next one is asking the president to cut emissions by 50%. Again, the only way he can guarantee it, he can't guarantee it through market mechanisms. He can't guarantee it by putting a tax on carbon. I'm sorry, we got to stop that. It's a ridiculous concept. We have to say, if you want to cut emissions by 50%, you must cut production and consumption now. How do you do it? It is still a market mechanism. You double the mileage that's required of every car. That's not just a market mechanism. It says to the manufacturers, you can't make, for every Hummer that you make, you must make 10 cars that make 50 and 60 and 70 miles to a gallon. You get it? So it forces. It's not technology encouraging. It's technology forcing. So what I'm getting to for a lot of you out there is you got a lot of opinions, right? You got a lot of things you think are right and wrong. But what are the demands that we want to place on the system? Now I'm going to move to another one, which is a similar dynamic here. I got something in the mail from Sharda Sakhadan from the Drug Policy Alliance. It's Sharda, Sharda.Sakhadan, Sekaran, at drugpolicy.org. And I'm going to go check my tweets and see if any of you sent me anything. Oh, man, come on, guys. I appreciate Zero Badinian, but isn't there anybody else who likes me or loves me on at Eric Mann Speaks? Come on, guys. All you have to do is say one thing about the article or say one thing about a book that you like. All right. I'm leaving my Twitter account for a minute. I'm back to the fact that I answer people's emails. All right. So this is from the Drug Policy Alliance. It says Eric. See, they personally sent it to me. President Barack Obama granted clemency to 46 people incarcerated in federal prison for nonviolent drug offenses. It's a positive step, but it's far from enough. While I'm grateful these 46 men and women are able to walk free today, I can't help but think of the hundreds of thousands of people still sitting in prison right now for nothing more than a drug law violation and the thousands more arrested every day. Please send a message to President Obama now. Tell him to free many more victims of the drug war and to do everything in his power to end this disastrous war. It's time for the White House to take a bolder stand. Now, my friends in the Drug Policy Alliance, this isn't adequate, let alone acceptable. You can't just tell him to free many more victims. If you say 46 is not enough and you don't tell him how many you want to free, then he'll free 92. You said many more, or free 143. I think we have to say, free all the people that are presently in prison on drug offenses. Now, I asked Channing Martinez, one of the organizers and researchers of the Strategy Center, and he just gave me one number. 95,265 people are in prison for drug offenses. 95,265. That's a real number. Drug Policy Alliance says hundreds of thousands of people still prison. So they should give, if the first, and this was a very superficial Google search, if we got 95,265 and they say that's hundreds of thousands, then ask for hundreds of thousands to be freed. You can say it's a positive step, but it's far from enough. Why is it a positive step to release 46 people when there's somewhere between 95,000 and 200,000 people? We got to step up the demands on the president. This is the level of saying you're moving in the right direction, but not fast enough. No. If we freed 100,000 people and there were 200,000 people in prison, I know what a reform is. I think that's terrific. If we freed 15,000 people and there's 200,000 people in prison, that would be a jarring enough impact. What? He freed 15,000? He freed 50,000? He freed 100,000? He's starting to sound like the Strategy Center with that free the U.S. 2.5 million. But I'm sorry, you can't say I'm grateful these 46 men and women are able to walk free when there's 200,000 people just on drug charges and there's 2.5 million people in prison. So it's very important. This is not counter-hegemonic enough. No, it's not counter-hegemonic. It's not. I think you have to come up with demands that are structural, and then you have to ask the president to really do it. I welcome, of course, our friends from DPA to respond to my response to their work. But since I've been a big fan, this is not one of their better statements. And then in the last 5 minutes I have, there's four books I brought with me today. And you can tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks with any suggestions about what you think your favorite books are. Okay, here's one. Sun Ra. I recommend a memoir of former prisoner of the war on terror, Alternate View at Aplang at Sun Ra. It says, 5 years of my life, an innocent man in Guantanamo. Thank you. All right, let's keep those things going. So we have Labor's Untold Story by Boyer Moray, 5 years of my life, an innocent man in Guantanamo. It's great. Thank you so much. Let's keep the tweets coming. Now, I'm going to just tell you four books that I'm not going to be able to read in the short time. One is called The Crisis in the CPUSA by Harrison George. That's one of my favorite books. It's, you talk about obscure. You can get it in a used bookstore. It's a great book. I'm not going to read it to you now because I don't have a good enough quote. It's got a lot of internal fighting in it. But this was written, not that this is a bad thing, but Harrison George was a member of the Communist Party. In December of 1947, he basically accused the Communist Party of the United States as being a revisionist party. He criticized it, saying it was in socialist in theory, but in fact capitalist in its politics. There's one concept in here that I use all the time, which I used to challenge myself. He talked about tipping your hat to socialism, which, and I'll find the quote for next week. What he meant by that is that people in the party, they would sort of wake up in the morning and say, hello, socialism, I'm a socialist. And then they would go out and do liberal Democratic Party work. But the difference would be that they would say, well, I'm a socialist. I know some people in Freedom Road Socialist Organization who I think do the same thing, which is they're not really doing socialist work. But as one person said to me, well, at least I'm in the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. It makes me feel good about my work because I said, well, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm working inside the Democratic Party. I said, well, what's good about that? He said, well, it's not good. I feel terrible about it. I said, well, then why are you doing it? He says, because Freedom Road thinks this is a good thing to do. I said, well, you think it's a good thing to do? He said, well, I don't know. He says, but that's why I feel good I'm in a socialist organization, because I can feel better about the work I'm doing. Well, come back to that later, but that's what Harrison George was saying. And I think we at the Strategy Center have found ourselves at times tipping our hat to anti-imperialism. We say we're anti-imperialist, but are we every single day doing active anti-imperialist work? I think often we're not. And so the concept is, what's your ideology, and then what's your tactical plan, and is your tactical plan consistent with your ideology? If it's not, then that's not really your ideology. In other words, if we are not making demands on the president to deposit $100 billion into the Green Climate Fund, which means giving U.S. money to the third world so they can develop economically around climate, because the United States is the greatest polluter in the world, if we make demands for the President of the United States to free the U.S. 2.5 million, if tell him to stop bringing military-grade weapons, then at least we're starting to talk, and if we talk to people about imperialism and socialism. So that's the Crisis in the CPUSA, and I want to be very clear that I mainly use this book to challenge myself. It's a great, great book. The second book that I just got that I'm very excited about is called Germany's Black Holocaust, 1890-1945, The Untold Truth, Details Never Revealed Before, by Firpo W. Carr, Ph.D. For the first time ever in a book, three different blacks tell stories that are in intimate involvement with the Holocaust, all from a different perspective. One is an actual black Holocaust survivor from Dachau. One was a commander with the U.S. Army unit that liberated Dachau, and one was with the medical corps that went in to clean up the dead bodies at Dachau. Once we got to Dachau, we were in for the shock of our lives. Aside from the horror that was beyond description, we were completely surprised to see 8,000 blacks from World War I. They looked at us and we stared back at them. We just stared at one another in disbelief. The point is that this is about that Germany in the area of Africa called Namibia carried out a genocide from 1890 to 1945, and that the roots of the attacks on the Jews were not unique, and they were not, oh my God, that breaks with European tradition, but rather the concept of genocide is inherent in the development of Christian European imperialist capitalism. So this is a book I'm very excited about reading, because I'll also be meeting with a lot of German friends, and some people have just asked if they could translate my book, The Seven Components of Transformative Organizing and Playbook for Progressives, into German, which is a strange feeling. And I'm going to say yes if I can write an introduction to the German edition, challenging them about German fascism and German racism, just as my book is trying to challenge U.S. imperialism. And I'm getting the Here Comes the Sun. The last, which I am going to read you from next week, is called We Charge Genocide, The Crime of Government Against the Negro People. William L. Patterson, editor, with a preface, an amazing preface by Ozzie Davis. Obviously, I'm doing a lot of thinking of genocide because I'm doing a 10th anniversary of my book, Katrina's Legacy. And I'm just discussing U.S. genocidal climate crimes. And the last book that I'm reading among the 20 is A People's History of the Third World, Vijay Prashad's The Darker Nations, one of my favorite books. I just read it over and over and over again. All right, I'm being told to get out of here. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. I want to thank G. I want to thank Channing. I want to thank the authors. I want to say hello to Leanne. And I'll see you next week, Tuesday at 4. All power to the people. Here comes the sun.